Fast Money starts right now, live from the Nasdaq market site overlooking New York City's Times Square. I'm Melissa Lee. Your traders on the desk are Pete Najarian, Karen Feinerman, Mark Tepper, and Dan Nathan. Tonight on Fast, Disney jumping after a big earnings beat as the call gets underway. Fast Money friend and former TiVo CEO Tom Rogers will be here to weigh in on the move, and he's got a few words for CEO Bob Iger. Plus, stocks on a slow grind higher, the Dow rallying more than 170 points today to its highest level in 2 months. This is the S&P 500 closes just pennies beneath its 200-day moving average. One top strategist says it's rally on from here. He will explain. But we start off with the State of the Union just hours away as President Trump is getting ready to address the nation. And with a number of key issues like trade hanging in the balance, what should Wall Street watch out for? Let's get to Eamon Javers at the White House with more on that. Hi, Eamon.
Yeah, hi, Melissa. I talked to the vice president about this briefly yesterday. I asked him what we could expect to hear in the State of the Union. He said a lot of good stuff about the economy, so watch for that. Otherwise, officials here are relatively tight-lipped about any major announcements. One thing we're going to be watching for is whether or not the president announces a date for his apparent upcoming meeting with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. He suggested that the two leaders will get together at some point. Not clear exactly when that will be. We'll watch for an announcement tonight on that as well. And aides here are walking us through some of the themes in tonight's address, some of the issues that the president will be going through, starting with immigration, which has been such a partisan slugfest over the past month or so here in Washington. But the administration is convinced that there is some kind of a bipartisan deal here on this and all of these other themes that they're talking about tonight, including on trade, infrastructure, lowering health care and prescription drug costs, and national security. Administration officials suggesting that the president wants to reach out in an uplifting tone here to Democrats, offering some kind of compromise on each one of those issues, or at least a bipartisan Venn diagram in which there's some overlapping interest between these two parties. But as we've seen, it has been a partisan slugfest here in Washington over the past couple of weeks. And even today, the president trading tweets with the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, each accusing the other of impropriety here in the hours leading up to the State of the Union. So the tone here, not a good one. We'll see whether the president can change that tonight in the State of the Union.
Yeah, certainly not the same crowd that he had, Eamon, just a year ago when he delivered this address. When it comes to these issues, Eamon, though, do you see that there are real, I don't want to say possibilities, but probabilities of bipartisanship when it comes to certain issues like infrastructure or drug pricing?
You know, drug pricing, maybe. It starts to feel like we're already so close to 2020 with a lot of the Democrats having announced their campaigns. It feels like half the Senate Democrats are running for president this year. None of those people will have any incentive to work with the president on anything, to give him a victory on any issue. So I don't think there's a lot of room for bipartisan compromise.
Even if it's a victory for themselves?
Even on something like, say, infrastructure. One thing to watch on infrastructure is how both sides approach the environment in a very different way. A Republican infrastructure bill would probably have a lot of environmental regulatory exemptions and ways to speed up the process. Democrats probably wouldn't approach it that way at all. So when they get down to hammering out the actual legislation and what's in it, you can see a myriad of ways where even something where they have an interest that's common, like on infrastructure, they can get bogged down in the details and not see eye to eye and not able to make much progress. It does not feel very optimistic today in Washington. We'll see if the president, like I say, can change that tone with his speech tonight and whether it carries through the early morning tweets tomorrow.
All right, Mr. Sunshine, Eamon Javers, thank you. So will President Trump's words hurt or help this rally as the trade deadline and another potential government shutdown are just around the corner? Pete, what do you say? Eamon certainly was not optimistic. He laid out some very good reasons why, though, as to why this is going to continue.
It's going to be a part of this at all. I still think it comes down to the trade agreement as much as anything out there. I mean, we talk about Powell. We've talked about the Fed for a long time, and now we're talking about the trade agreement. Can Mr. Trump, President Trump, actually get something accomplished there? I think that's the key. But I can tell you this, from the options perspective, it has stayed exactly the same status quo for about a month and a half. Everything is short term. Nobody wants to go out long term. And as we've seen volatility pull back, we are seeing people buy protection further out, but everybody's trading in this environment. I'm not so sure we're in an environment right now where people are actually investing. Feels much more like trading to me.
So sort of like a wait and see. I mean, it does seem like this is a first half of the year sort of issue, right, Mark? I mean, where all these things are front loaded in the first half of the year, by this back half of the year, in theory, they should be resolved.
I certainly would hope so. I'm hoping we hear some good stuff out of the State of the Union tonight. I really think it's going to be constructive. You know, I am confident that Trump is a friend of the market. When I heard right after the Christmas Eve sell-off that he was reaching out to hedge fund managers to get advice on how to prop up the market, it really gave me some confidence that he wants to give himself an attaboy and give himself credit when the market goes up. So I do think we're going to hear some positive progress on trade. And I think that's the biggest thing other than the Fed that could help to propel the market forward.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get any positive progress on trade. That's going to happen, you know, February 15th is going to come, and then you're going to have a situation which could get a lot more hairy if he does declare a state of emergency, and then you have a situation where it basically assures that there will be no bipartisan anything from here on out, because that's going to be wrapped up in the courts, and they're going to be doing things by transferring monies from other places to do this sort of thing. So that's a really bad setup, and that's February 15th. And then we get to this March 1st deadline on trade. And I got to tell you, if he were to actually shut the government down instead of doing the emergency, what do the Chinese really have? You know, what incentive do they have to actually cut a deal that just kicks the can down the road?
Because their own economy is hurting.
Well, but the own economy is hurting anyway, Mel. I mean, when you literally think about what are we talking about? We're talking about 20% tariffs or 25% tariffs on $250 billion worth of goods or whatever. I mean, their economy is hurting, but they're finding other places to sell their goods. I actually don't think it's as dire for the Chinese as you know, this is a country that has the 2025 plan stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. Just a few weeks ago, though, President Xi was talking to top communist leaders saying that they need to do everything that in their power to prevent political instability because of the economic slowdown. I mean, when you're talking about political instability and the possibility of that, that really underscores sort of the dire straits that the Chinese might actually be in.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is the best hand that we've had to negotiate with the Chinese in a really long time. I think ultimately we'll get a deal. I don't think that March 1st is necessarily a binary event. I think if the talks are progressing, right, then we could kick it down the road a little bit further. I think, to me, the most important thing in this market is still trade. It's interesting that, you know, we see some names like Boeing today, that's starting to have a lot of positive things priced into it already. And I don't think it's also interesting to me. So on December, whatever the low was, this was mispriced $75 billion.
On market cap, yeah.
That's crazy. That's
so Boeing above 400, buyer or seller of that?
I'd probably be a buyer, because actually, if you really look at what's happened with Boeing over the last couple of quarters and maybe even a couple of years, take a look at the earnings growth. Take a look at this cash flow that we talk about all the time. They gave out that guidance. They've got three different pillars in which they have double-digit growth. So when you have a company like that trading at 20, maybe 22 times, it sounds a little bit expensive. But quite frankly, with the cash they're putting off, Mel, I think it's really interesting. And I think that's the big theme that I'm taking away so far from the earnings season has been cash flows. And it seems like the market wants to hear about cash and how much people are making, whether it's Google, whether it's Apple, whether it's anybody. They want to know, are you throwing off a lot of cash?
So
what are you doing?
When the stock was below 300 a month ago, were people talking about the tremendous cash flows? You couldn't give the stock away. I just think that people are getting absolutely turned around right here. Mel, you just said it. I mean, there's a lot of good news that is in the market right here. You know, David Rosenberg of Glufkenschef, he put out we haven't talked about the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. It's trading at two-year lows right now. What do you think that's telling you about the global economy? No one thinks that the U.S. economy is going to lead the globe into a recession right here. It's coming from China. It's coming from Europe. The data's weak.
But you just said that China wasn't as big of a threat, and now you're saying that they are suffering, because Mel was just talking about that. They are suffering. And even if the plan is 2025.
But it's all interrelated. So what I'm saying is people have been calling the doom of the Chinese economy. It's a centrally planned economy. They have one. They don't have to do bipartisan. It's one party, okay?
Right.
So they're not sweating a March 1st deadline. They're just not, okay? Talk to anybody over there who does business over
there,
who invests over there. What's that?
There aren't any elections to worry about.
No, but I'm just telling you, I talk to people over there. They're not worried the way we are on fast money. And so I'm just telling you, you're doing it wrong if you're getting all geeked up about the market here on February 5th, up 17% from the lows, when people were giving away stocks at valuations despite the cash flows.
I would say that your vision is correct, that the people that are in charge are looking at 2025. How about the people underneath them? They aren't very happy about that, and that's what they need to address. That's why they want to make a deal as bad as we do. And I think that is part of the reason that they are in such dire straits right now. They need to get a deal. It doesn't happen to don't think it happens March 1st.
As your president says, and he'll probably say it 10 times tonight, we'll see. We'll see.
Right.
Let's say we get a deal.
Uh-huh.
Which stocks or sectors would see the most bounce? Oh. And is China actually the better investment off the back of a trade deal?
They may both be it, right? I mean, I think industrials are a great place to be. I think United Rentals, something like that, is a great place to be. Auto, I mean, autos have been really hurt by this. I think that would be a good place to be. Just one thing I want to point out from last night, though, with Google turning around today. I was on a plane, but I caught a 1 minute of Jim, and he said something really smart, which isn't surprising. He's very smart. That he loves to listen to a call in a vacuum without knowing how the call was received, right? Whether people thought it was good or bad. The earnings
call. Oh, you mean without any sort of analysis or whatever?
Not knowing where the stock trades. Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting because there was a lot to like in that report last night. And so if you put up good numbers, even with the market having bounced so much, I think you'd be rewarded. And interestingly, Google ended up today.
But it seems like anybody who said, we've got good numbers or decent numbers, but we're going to spend money on investments, they kind of get slammed.
Listen, it was fine, okay? I mean, the stock was down 15%, but they have decelerated revenue growth, and they have their operating margins at the lowest level it's been in multiple years. So, you know, if
and
you're really...
And where is their multiple?
But they're spending
the
on the...
Level
you know what?
It's, been.
It's actually not. It's actually above 20 for the
back
first time.
Back out
so
the cash. They keep building. I mean, back out the
cash. Okay, well, we could have backed out the cash on Apple for 5 years when it just dropped 35%. I mean, listen, guys. I mean, this is... You know how to do this. I mean, like, on a PE to growth, it was trading in the teens, and now it's trading...
I blow the whistle on this conversation. We're moving on. For more on how the president's State of the Union could impact key areas of the market, let's bring in former U.S. senior Treasury official Kim Wallace. He is now the managing director of the Eurasia Group. Kim, it is great to see you, especially on this night. We want to do a little rapid fire of the key issues that could be addressed. We start off with trade. What are you expecting? Are you expecting any encouraging words, any revealing of the cards that he's got in front of him?
I don't expect revealing of the cards, but I do expect optimism from the president, both because there's a conversation being held within the administration as to what they want to do and when they want to do it on trade with China, but also because, as has been stated on your panel, there are a lot of people hoping for optimism when it comes to trade because that's what most people in the markets are paying attention to. My view is that this is a much longer conversation, that the competition between China and the U.S. is multi-pronged and will not be resolved easily, and that all of those elements will impinge on trade talks. You could see conclusion of trade talks around transactional numbers of China buy that don't do anything to resolve the underlying differences on tech transfer, on the way that business is run in China, and more importantly, adherence to WTO rules. I also have to add that I am no longer with the Eurasia Group.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for your update, Kim, and thanks so much for joining us, even though you're not with them. I wanted to get to a point that our White House reporter, Eamon Javers, was making just a short time ago, and that is that he didn't think that there really was any hope for bipartisanship given the 2020 elections around the corner, and that the Dems are not looking to give President Trump any sort of wins. I wanted to know what your take on that was in the context of infrastructure and drug pricing, because those seem like issues that could be construed as a win for either side.
I tend to favor Eamon's view of this, as dark as it is, in large part because the work that they have to do this year on Capitol Hill is fiscal. And it starts in 10 days. It continues into debt limit, as you all have been talking about in the spring. And then it goes into the back end of the beginning of the fiscal year, October 1. The history for the past 10 years has not been constructive, certainly not optimistic when it comes to those negotiations. So I think how fiscal goes this year is how the year is going to go. On the issues that you raise, infrastructure spending is a favorite of everyone in all parties. My sense is that there's a better chance for an infrastructure deal in a countercyclical program, whether that's this year, next year, or 2021. And on health care, that's something near and dear to most voters' hearts. I think both Republicans and Democrats understand the power of remaining on the right side of voters when it comes to health care. And so what we saw in terms of the administration announcing that it was going to attempt to reduce drug prices by affecting people who sell drugs in between the transactions, look for more of that adjustment. I don't look for a big legislative agreement between Republicans and Democrats on what to do about health care policy going forward.
All right. Kim, thank you so much for your thoughts. We appreciate it. Kim Wallace in Washington, D.C. for us. Mark, I want to go to you. We were talking about drug pricing. You've liked health care. Do you think this is going to be an issue, especially as we have Senate Finance Committee hearings in a couple weeks and a lot of the CEOs are going to be there?
Yeah, on a short-term basis, I do think it could potentially be an issue and cap some of these prices. But when we look at a more secular trend in diabetes management, cancer management, I do think a lot of the companies that we're focusing on are still going to be very good plays over the course of the next few years.
Your top picks?
My top picks right now?
Healthcare, yeah.
Oh, and healthcare, I still love Merck. I still think there's plenty of upside there. I own Pfizer as well. And I think some of these biotechs, they're going to start to turn pretty soon because they got to start spending that cash.
All right. Quick programming note here as we head to break. Two big interviews tomorrow, starting with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. That kicks off at 8 a.m. on Squawk Box. And then you can catch Steve Leisman's exclusive interview with former Fed Chair Janet Yellen. That is tomorrow afternoon on Power Lunch. You will want to watch both of those interviews. Coming up on Fast, check out some of our big earnings movers tonight. Disney is higher while Snap soars and Electronic Arts sinks. We will bring you the very latest. Plus, the stocks surge off the lows. One top strategist says he's got three reasons. New highs are coming, and Fast, he'll be here. And later, Pete here stepping up to the plate to pitch one under-the-radar tech stock he says is about to break out. He'll give us his Fast pitch. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this. We've got an earnings alert for you on Disney, which is higher in the after-hours session, but off the session highs, as you see there. Let's get over to Julia Borson in Los Angeles with the latest from the call. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Melissa. Disney's shares giving up some of their gains over the course of the call as Disney CFO Christine McCarthy warned that the studio will continue to face tough comparisons, saying it should report between $450 million and $500 million less in revenue than in the year earlier quarter. Now, on the call, CEO Bob Iger has been focusing on Disney's direct-to-consumer business, announcing that ESPN Plus now has 2 million subscribers. That's double the number from 5 months ago, also saying he's bullish on the upcoming Disney Plus.
And we're confident our iconic brands and franchises will allow us to effectively break through the competitive clutter and connect with consumers. We'll also use our brands to help subscribers quickly navigate the content on Disney Plus, creating an efficient interface that enhances their experience and their affinity for the service.
Iger saying he's open to buying more brands to bolster their library like they did with the acquisition of Lucasfilm, and saying the way the company is structured enables them to leverage their brands for digital at minimal additional costs.
We have in the Walt Disney Company not only a collection of brands, and we're adding to them with National Geographic and FX and Searchlight, et cetera, and so on, but we have talent, both executive talent, talent relationships, and production capabilities that give us the ability to scale up nicely in terms of our output and not invest that much in overhead or infrastructure to do that.
Iger also saying he believes there's huge potential for Hulu to grow. Melissa, remember that Disney will control 60% of Hulu once that Fox deal closes. Back to you.
All right, Julia, thank you. Julia Borson in Los Angeles. So, Pete, you own Disney, so what do you make of the quarter? What do you make of the emphasis on DTC business?
I think that's something we've been talking about for a while. That's the shift they've had to make. And I think we all have agreed upon the fact that they've been slow to do this.
Oh, yeah.
But they finally are in the process of doing it. That's great. I think it's something that they're behind the eight ball right now. They still got to make up a lot of room because they are still way behind at this point.
Yeah, they're late to the game. I mean, Netflix is spending, what, $8 billion a year developing original content? I mean, that would be a significant stride for Disney to make if they really wanted to compete head-to-head with Netflix. Yes, Hulu would help them to get there partially, but I do think they have their challenges in the streaming market.
Well, they're actually spending a lot more than $8 billion, but the billions Netflix that they're spending on original content, it makes up less than 10% of their entire catalog. What does Disney have? They have a catalog, and they're pulling their best stuff from Netflix. I think to say that Bob Iger is late to the game, given what they're doing, the fact that this stock is not down more on that guidance that they just gave about this product, the fact that cable subscriptions only declined 1%, I think investors are going to give them a little time to figure this out as they...
Haven't they already? What has the stock done for 2 years?
Okay, so
that's the problem. I don't disagree with you. I own the stock. But my point is they are late to the game.
So in 2015, it traded 122. It traded as low as, 90-something. So here we are at $113, I'd say. It trades at a market multiple. They have some catalysts here.
I own it because of a couple of reasons. I still think even though he is slow to it, Iger is still as good a CEO as there is out there. He's made great acquisitions over time that have, to your point, that's where their book is in terms of what they own. All the these brands, everything else. But I just think that the streaming is something that they just kicked to the side for far too long.
But now that they've decided to do it, they haven't lost any position. They haven't lost any sort of
But it's going to be a little bit tougher, I think, to make up a lot of that room, even if they are pulling away, which they are, from Netflix.
For more on Disney and media, let's bring in Tom Rogers, longtime media executive and CNBC contributor. Tom, it is always great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Can Disney catch up at this point in terms of DTC streaming?
Well, the state of the Magic Kingdom is as important as the State of the Union when it comes to temperature of the media industry. I think Disney successfully changed the narrative here to talk about streaming. I don't think things have really changed for investors in terms of the state of play. And what I mean by that is the traditional business, make no mistake about it, is in decline. It is truly in decline. They're managing it well. The results today show they're managing it well. But subscribers are going to continue to decline. Viewership is declining. Kids' viewership is in free fall. And that's bread and butter stuff for Disney. So overall, they got a lot to manage through. So the question is, how big is the direct-to-consumer streaming business going to be?
Can it offset that decline in the core businesses?
And the thing they got to do in changing this narrative is they got to get away from the Netflix comparison. They cannot catch Netflix. Netflix is going to have 170 million subs by the end of the year, and Disney will just be launching. Netflix will probably have 300 million subs in the next 5 years. The best estimates I've seen on Disney Plus over that period of time is 50 million, and that's stretching it. Remember, there are only 35 million households in this country with kids 5 to 15. That's what Disney Plus is going to appeal to, and it's going to be some subset of that. ESPN Plus, off to a good start, but 2 million subs is one thing. They need 3 million subs just to pay for their half of the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting package that they picked up, and that's one sport, one rights contract. So they got a lot to prove here that I don't think helps when Netflix is the bar that they have to meet in terms of success.
So let's say the street gives them some time, right? They're a premier company and they've got great management. Let's say 3 or 4 quarters down the road, where do they need to be for you to think, all right, they're really gaining some traction here, even if they're not remotely close to Netflix?
I think we're just going to be getting evidence of the beginning of something in 3 or 4 quarters from now. I think we're really going to have to be a good year and a half into the Disney Plus launch to have a sense of this. But, you know, they don't have a lot of their content. It is tied up still in Netflix. It is still tied up when it comes to the Fox acquisition in HBO. There's a lot of that that they aren't going to be able to pull back immediately. So it is going to be the new stuff and originals. And when I hear people talking about, well, they got a lot of content, a lot of it they're not going to be able to rely on. You don't talk about Netflix and watching it because it has Avengers Infinity Wars, one of Disney's films. You talk about watching Netflix because of the originals. And I haven't heard yet the kind of commitment to original production and the kind of originals that they're going to need to invest in. And to Pete's comment earlier about cash and the street is looking for cash, that is a huge commitment in additional cash beyond anything I think people have really begun to model, and that's where the rubber is going to hit the road when we see what they're going to do there.
What should Iger be doing then? What's your advice?
Well, one, I would get into sports gaming and gambling on ESPN. Inexplicably, they're staying away from that. A full disclosure, I have personal interest in the company I run in that sector. That's the big pool of revenue in sports. I don't understand them staying away from it. Two, I would lower expectations by just getting rid of this Netflix comparison.
They're not making it, though, are they?
No, but they feed into it. And they should talk about these being streaming businesses with the potential for success without that having to be held over their heads. And three, they got to be able to manage growth going for it, the way Netflix just goes for growth, without having to be too preoccupied with managing the decline. When the recession hits, cord cutting is going to accelerate like nobody is predicting.
Right.
Advertising is going to be hit. The parks are going to be hit. We all know the recession is going to come. Those are things that can really get in the way of your focus on growth, and you got to make sure your organization is prepared to continue to focus on growth all the way.
All right, Tom, great to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having
me. Tom Rogers. Right. All right, what do you
think, Tom? Fascinating. While we're still making the comparison to Netflix, Netflix had negative free cash flow of like $3 to $4 billion last year on that spend on original content. I think if anybody's able to actually make a decision to kind of compete with Netflix on the original content, it's going to be Disney. And so if Disney's going to have problems with cord cutting, those guys may have problems by pushing up the subscriber costs that they just did recently. How far can that go? I mean, to me, I think Disney's an easy one at this point.
All right, Disney not the only earnings mover tonight. Check out shares of Snap. They're soaring. Electronic Arts crashes on their results, down 15%. We're bringing the very latest on the stocks. Plus, rally on as stocks soar off the lows. One top strategist says the market has nowhere to go but up from here. Find out what's got them so bullish. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC. First in business worldwide. Much more Fast Money still ahead. The market melt-up continues as the S&P closes just pennies beneath its 200-day moving average. The index is now up nearly 17% from the depths of December, and it's been somewhat of a dash for trash as once beaten down sectors like industrials and energy lead the way. But with the growth trade getting back in high gear in the last 2 weeks, is this a recipe for a bigger rally? Let's bring in Phil Camporelli, asset allocation strategist at J.P. Morgan Asset Management. Phil, great to have you with us.
Hello.
Why new highs? We're going to see new highs from here?
Yeah, so just to qualify that a little bit, not as bullish as we were at this point last year when every PMI and growth rate globally was going up at the same time.
Right.
However, nowhere near as bearish as what the market was telling us at the end of last year. So three reasons for that. So to quote the late, great Prince, this is what it sounds like when doves cry. Right.
Wow.
I mean, I think that is a clear pivot that Powell made, and people have talked about it a lot. It does two things. One, it eliminates some of that policy error concern, that tail risk of the Fed just moving too much kind of blindly. That was one of the reasons why we took equities down last year. The other thing it does, it elongates the cycle. So if you have a year this year where inflation stays around the Fed's target, growth stays positive, and earnings just stay positive, that's usually a good runway from here for stocks. The second is trade. And I heard the last segment, we don't expect some grand plan on trade by March 1st. However, there's low-hanging fruit. One of those low-hanging fruits is just no new tariffs. That would be a win in terms of certainty between China and U.S. trading partners. And I think the third is earnings. So earnings season this year hasn't been spectacular. I think 70% have beaten on EPS. That compares to high 70s of prior quarters. But there's a big difference this time. Companies that beat are rallying on average by over 2.5% that day versus that's the best in 12 quarters. We haven't seen stuff like this. And a lot of that has to do with where we were kind of going into this earnings season with completely beaten down expectations.
Right.
So reasons to be optimistic. Melissa.
So is it more just that that expectations have been reset, or is there a real change? You mentioned global PMIs.
Because yep.
Global PMIs really indicated the downturn before a lot of the equity markets
yep.
had indicated the downturn last year.
Yep.
Are we seeing an upturn? Are we seeing an inflection point in them or no?
Yeah, so the way we're characterizing this, Melissa, is this is like a financial conditions rally, right? What does that mean? It means that the Fed, a lot like they did in prior parts of this cycle, are taking a pause. And you saw today, stocks up, bonds up, right? This is less of a fundamentally driven rally that we expect U.S. growth to be at 4% or earnings to be at mid-20s. So I would say less of a fundamental story of gangbuster growth, which is what we were saying last year, more of just the kind of financial conditions environment that is positive for taking risk. And by the way, China's doing stimulus as well. The dollar, the Fed being on the sideline, that's a positive EM story, and that's something we didn't say at all last year.
Does it worry you a little bit, though? So for a good part of last year, off of the Q1 lows, the market rallied and yields rallied too,
yeah.
right? And the markets were equity markets were comfortable with that. Now we've had this reversal in yields, and it's happening because the Fed has gotten a lot more dovish, back
yeah.
to your little Prince quote. Doesn't that make you a little worried how late in the cycle we are and betting for new highs at this point? I don't know. What are the catalysts?
Yeah, so the Fed has now introduced volatility as well. So they've backed themselves into the corner. If we see some sort of kind of gangbuster rally in the S&P blowing past 3,000 or something like that, or if we see inflation not cooperating and they have to come back in, We're not pricing that in. We think the Fed's going to be on the sideline for the better part of this year. So if that happens, that's a problem. And in terms of late cycle, I think there are two risks in late cycle. One is holding an asset class that falls. We saw that in the fourth quarter. The other risk is thinking that a recession is going to happen in 2 months, and the cycle lasts 2 years. So we're not talking about kind of 2013, 2014 type returns in the market. We're talking more about the elongated cycle based on the Fed telling us they're at a neutral rate. And that is very different from December. In December, they told us we want to go a couple of more times and we're not going to adjust the balance sheet, right? So they have made a complete 180 on that.
Phil, thanks for coming by.
Sure.
Good to see you. Phil Camparelli, JP Morgan Asset Management. Pete, are you as bullish as Phil is?
I don't know that I'm as bullish as what I'm hearing, but from what I see out there, I mean, this has been the greatest trading environment in the last 3, 4, 5 weeks that I've seen in a long time. I mean, it's been kind of crazy. The moves that we're seeing in short periods of time, whether you're talking about some of these FANG names or some of the industrial names, it doesn't matter. Pick your poison other than financials. We are seeing movements that's very, very rapid. And so am I bullish that that's going to continue? Probably not. But I do like the environment that he's talking about, which is, hey, look, maybe the trade's not completely taken care of, this trade war, but at the same time, maybe they extend it out and just stop the tariff talk back and forth against one another.
But don't you get back into that same box where the markets go up enough and then the Fed may pivot again? I mean, if we're celebrating the Fed for pivoting,
if it goes up too much.
Exactly, because of market volatility and a change in conditions, yes. The Fed can do the opposite, too, if things reverse.
If things reverse, I don't know how far. I don't know they'll wait to exactly fair value. They'll probably wait a little longer. I'm not as excited. He gets very excited, apparently, which is good. I don't want to trade around things, but with the volatility index coming down as much as it has, I think in the mid-teens, I'm going to start buying some more protection against the long.
Yeah, so we're bullish. I do think that that the Fed is on pause right now. I call it the Powell pause. I think trade right now is the most important thing because I do believe that the Fed's pause is really the majority of it's priced in. I mean, last January, we were at a forward PE on the S&P 500 of about 18. We came limping into January 1st of this year at a forward PE down at 14. We're back almost up to 16. I think that's pretty reasonable given where the Fed is at right now. Now we need to see some progress on trade. I don't think we're going to get a deal done by March 1st. We just saw the longest punt in Super Bowl history on Sunday. It was the only exciting thing that happened. I think we're going to see a punt. I don't think we're going to see anything by March 1st.
Yeah, I guess what I was just trying to say is that yields going down for the wrong reasons this time, with crude oil pausing, maybe for like reasons that aren't great for the global economy. We already talked about the Baltic Dry. And then you think about what's one group that really has not participated in the U.S. market here over the last couple weeks, which I think is really important. He was telling you the tale all last year, and that's banks. They just cannot get going since that period right after earnings. So to me, I think there's enough reasons as the market feels like it's just floating up a little bit more. It's right at that 200-day moving average in the S&P 500. There's enough reasons to not get in there and buy at this point because you feel like you missed out.
Coming up, two big earnings movers, two very different directions. Snap soaring while Electronic Arts is getting crushed. We'll tell you what is driving the stocks. Plus, Pete here bringing the heat, warming up to pitch one soaring chip stock he says is about to rip even higher. The name? What it has in pounding the table when fast money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Semiconductor stocks surging alongside the market from the December lows, with SMH ETF that tracks the group up more than 22% from the bottom. Pete here says there's one name in the group that could break out even higher. Pete, why don't you head on over to the plasma?
Hey, I'm going to head on over to the plasma, especially if Mel tells me to go to the plasma, I go to the plasma. Let me tell you something about this stock today. Yes, it's already made a move. Don't get nervous about that. I'm doing on semi. Now, the reason I like this one so much is a variety of reasons. This CEO's got 30 years of experience. He's been at the company since 2002. And oh, by the way, I wrote in here the acquisitions, right? This guy has executed on 19 acquisitions since taking over this company. So this is really interesting how they're building these bolt-ons and what they're doing with sensors. This is the self-driving car stock that a lot of people don't know about. Everybody knows NVIDIA. Everybody knows Intel bought Mobileye. This one's very much stealth, but it shouldn't be, and people are finding out more and more about them. When you look at the fundamental story of this company, even though it's made this huge run to the upside, trades at about 11 or a 12 PE. I like what we're seeing in this company there. And I'll tell you what, here's a look at the chart. You can see where this was. You can also see where it's been. But look at this move. Don't let that move scare you. I think this thing has plenty of room to be able to get back up to potentially at least these levels. Call it 25, 26, something like that. And oh, by the way, the last little point that I had on that first slide was the call buying. They've been buying calls. They started last week. They were buying huge amounts of calls. And today came back for even more. They were going to March 22 calls. Very, very aggressively positioning for this stock to go to the upside. It's still inexpensive, and they've got all kinds of growth. There's a lot of reasons to like this company.
Dan has a question.
Yeah, hey, Pete. So obviously it trades pretty cheap to most in its group. You know, but the consensus is calling for 6% EPS decline year over year and flat sales growth. So trading 11, 12 times, is it really that cheap? And when are you expecting the cycle to kick in?
Well, I think it's still cheap, Dan. And one of the things is this is a China play. If we get a deal, this is a name because they're so dependent on China that really could explode this to the upside. And they're throwing off a lot of cash. No China deal. Yeah, we might see a big pullback. That's why I'm in the options right now. I'm not in the stock. I am in the calls.
No more questions. Time to vote. Are you buying or selling Pete's pitch for onsemi? Karen, what do you say?
Yeah, I got to pass. It just the chart scares me. Like you said, Pete, I know it's.
That's okay.
You need cojones. I don't have
a lot of charts at the bottom of the ocean, you know. A lot of them.
True. Excellent point.
Mark.
I'm going to buy it, Pete. I think you did a good job. Great pitch.
Thanks, Mark.
Great form. I think you did a good job there. I think within the semis, it's really all about who the end user is. So I think exposure to enterprise spending, we're bullish on the cloud, we're bullish on 5G. The valuation looks good.
Dan?
Yeah, I'm selling mine to Mark, not a buyer. It wasn't a bad presentation. I just think the stocks run too far too fast. And if you think about if a big part of the story is what's going to happen with global trade, I'm not sure you want to be buying the stock up 30% right now.
Two sales and one buy here on the desk. Are you out there, though, buying Pete's pitch for onsemi? Vote in our Twitter poll at CNBC Fast Money. We will reveal the results later on in the show. Plus, check out Snap and Electronic Arts, both seeing huge moves in the after-hour session. Those conference calls are underway. We'll bring you the very latest when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Time for an earnings whip. Check out shares of Snap and Electronic Arts on the move in the after hours off the earnings reports. Those conference calls are wrapping up. Julia Borson's out in L.A. covering Snap. Josh Lipton's all over Wall Street's reaction to EA earnings in San Francisco. Julia, we go to you first.
Well, Melissa Evans-Spiegel, CEO of Snap, saying the company is stabilizing after a rough patch around Snapchat's redesign, saying they expect financial momentum to continue, bolstered by the opportunity in Snap's Android app and an interest in content in its Discover section.
As far as monetization is concerned, we're most focused on Discover and improving the depth of engagement there. We're really excited by the time spent improvements we're seeing around personalization. I think there's a lot more to do there, and also around merchandising content more effectively. I think today we see a lot of demand for content created by our community, user-generated content, and also huge demand for shows and more premium content.
As for competition from Facebook, especially in the Stories ad format that Snap pioneered and Instagram copied, the company says they're glad the format is gaining traction and that it will help Snap as well. Also saying their self-serve ad product is driving results, as is their ability to reach 70% of 13 to 34-year-olds. And to grow their user base, they are working on marketing, particularly overseas, and on reaching an older demographic. Melissa, that means older than 34. Take a look at Snap shares up over 20%. Back to you.
All right, Julia, thank you. Let's trade Snap. So up 20%. Is this a sign of life or is this just a short covering rally, Dan?
I don't think it is. I mean, listen, they've had a lot of...
You don't think it's what?
I don't think... It is signs of life.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And just listen to Evan on that call. I've listened to every call that they... You know, he sounds really energized. Now, he has to be energized. They've lost a lot of people over the last couple of years. But the big number right there is they're reaching 70% of 13 to 34-year-olds. It's a pretty unique platform for advertisers. So to me, I think the thing's been down in the dumps for months and doesn't surprise me that you have this huge gap right here on those numbers.
Mark?
So the issue I have with the 13 to 34-year-olds with the advertisers is they don't spend enough money. And if they're struggling...
Yeah, you should see my kids, dude. I'm just telling you.
Spend their parents' money.
I have to approve those purchases, though, from the kids. So they're struggling to get to that 34-plus crowd. And they're the ones that have the ability to spend. They've lost, what, two CFOs in the last year? I don't think that's a good look. They do really well with the filters, but I got to tell you, if I see one more filter with the doe eyes and the reindeer nose, I might have to shut down all my social media accounts. So I'm not a big fan of Snapchat.
Got the dogs and the fairy things. I mean, they got different. The hot dog was a real popular one.
I guess the most, you know, the giant short interest, right? So if you were here for the demise of this company, I think that maybe it's time to throw in the towel on that trade. I don't know if that's the same as there being big signs of life. I don't know.
Right. All right, let's move on to Electronic Arts. That is getting crushed. Josh Lipton's all over the story. Hey, Josh.
Melissa, let's check writing with the street's reaction. So I checked in with Michael Pachter of Wedbush. He didn't pull any punches. He said, listen, they missed badly on revenue. The full year guide, he pointed out, was even worse. The bright spot, such as it was live services flat year over year. It looks like Battlefield, he said, missed completely. Mobile got crushed. The stock, he says, deserves to be crushed on this print. Colin Sebastian over Baird Equity Research. Now, he put out a note to clients before the conference call, said he was more cautious given these results, which compounds, he said, existing concerns over franchise strength. In terms of what's going on here, CEO Andrew Wilson on the call pointed to a couple issues. Increasing competition in the holiday quarter that impacted sales of Battlefield 5. Remember, they had initially delayed that. He said mobile, harder than ever for new games to break through. On the call, they tried to talk about their pipeline, Anthem. That's a new game that's coming out later this month. They talked about the surprise announcement of Apex Legends, this new Battle Royale game. The head of that studio behind that game actually tweeted that the game broke 1 million unique players in under 8 hours. But obviously, you can see the reaction. Investors not concentrating on that right now, Melissa.
All right, Josh, thank you. Josh Lipton in San Francisco. Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I see the street with 23 buys, 11 holds, and zero sells. So if you're inclined to buy it, I think you got to wait. You got a lot of people who are going to have to issue big mea culpas tomorrow. And it's a three-day rule for this one, I think.
Yeah. Pete?
You know, the guidance was so bad, and the quarter was so bad, mm-hmm. and the fact that they're still struggling with mobile and all the different things that Josh was just going through, I think not only a three-day, I think this is a no-touch for a while until they show us. They've got to prove something now, because it seems like they're getting beat on every single front that they're trying to compete at.
Is there any hope for, is there another video game maker over EA? Is this an EA problem, so therefore you go somewhere else?
I would prefer Activision here, and I mean, I know that's trading way off its high, but really the biggest problem with EA is they haven't evolved as video games have evolved, and really they're still focused on selling units of their games, whereas everyone else that's doing it the right way, they're focusing on selling these in-game purchases. So it's all about the Battle Royale fighting, it's the Fortnite, it's the Call of Duty, so I prefer Activision
the
here.
The freemium model.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you guys kind of laid it out, three-day rule, whatever your rule is, I mean, the stock's going to be a new 52-week low in like the next few ticks here, and it's got an enterprise value of $20 billion, and they're going to have $5.5 billion in sales. We talk about the need for these companies to have content and platforms, and they're slow. We keep talking about these guys are slow to do that. They got the content. So this, to me, is with $4.5 billion in cash, with a $23 billion market, I think it's probably takeover bait down here. I would have said it $25 ago, maybe $50 ago, but it's more so down here now.
All right. Well, one options trader just made a whale of a bet on Wynn. See what has to happen for it to pay off next on Fast Money. We're live at the Nasdaq in Times Square. Much more Fast still ahead. Wynn Resorts soaring nearly 40% off the December lows, and one options trader is placing a $3.5 million bet that the casino stock is about to hit the jackpot. So, Dan, show us the cards.
Yeah, well, here you go. It was option volume. Call volume was 6 times the average daily volume, and it looked like a bullish roll up and out where a trader sold a call spread in March that he owned, or she, and then they rolled them out to April, buying the 10,000 of the April 135-150 call spreads, paying $3.50 for those break even at 138.50. So that's probably a long, just kind of looking to add some leverage and rolling it out a month. We have a couple charts here. Kind of interesting. The next identifiable catalyst will be their Q1 earnings. Look at that thing. If you're looking at how it just broke that downtrend and just got above that recent resistance, maybe it's due for a bit of a breakout. We do have a 10-year chart here, and this is the one that you got to be worried about if you're long and you're playing this thing off the lows. It's pretty much an epic head and shoulders top. If that thing fails, it is going right back to the neckline at 100 bucks, Pete. You better be owning calls by defining your risk rather than be long the stock.
That's the smartest way to play this thing right now. No, I'm not in there. Okay. And you know what? Ever since Steve Wynn had to step down, I've been very apprehensive to really be a part of this whole trade anymore.
Really? No Wynn, no stock for you?
I have not been in Wynn in quite a while now because of it.
just because Steve Wynn is out.
Yep,
you don't
because he was that big, and he was
behind.
The guy. He was buying when nobody thought their company was worth right. anything, all right. of that.
And he sold when he
and
left.
Sold.
Not just that he left, he sold. All right. Yeah. More Options Action, check out the full show Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, final trades. Welcome back to Fast. You see there, onsemi's up 2% after hours. So why is Pete so sad? Because America is not buying his pitch.
That's okay.
66% said no. 34% though said yes. So it's not, I mean, it's still Tony.
Yeah.
It's not Celine.
Hey, look, I like Tony Braxton.
Final trade.
You know what else I like?
What?
Movie Fast Five. You know why? Welcome to Brazil. EWZ will get you done. Giddy up.
I have no idea where you're going with that. Karen.
Haven't gone anywhere. Still looking for things that are cheap. I like FedEx right here. You know, it's up. Shouldn't have been down this much.
Mark Tepper.
I like O'Reilly. I think fears of electric vehicles and Amazon taking over the world are overblown when it comes to the auto parts retailer, so I think there's a lot of upside there.
Dan.
Fast Five is where they introduced The Rock, and you got The Rock. He's got nothing on you.
You're right.
EA, wait 3 days, then you buy that one in the low 70s.
In 3 days.
EA.
All right.
People don't know how much I love you.
Thanks for watching. That money's up next.
Hobbs.